Good morning, church. Good to see you all here this morning. I think I detect a few sweaters and jackets out here today. Imagine that, in the middle of November, right? It is good to see you all this morning. We're going to be continuing today with the Rocks Don't Float series that we've been in for the last few weeks here. And I want to start off today by asking you all a question. What comes to mind, what images come to mind when you hear the words rear view mirror? All right, I'm guessing most of us probably see that mirror that hangs from the inside of our windshield in the front of our cars. Maybe some of you envision that feeling that you get of glancing in the rearview mirror to look at the police officer in the back after you've passed him going 15 or 20 over. Maybe some of you give your kids the look in the rearview mirror when they're not exactly being angelic in the back seat. Maybe some of you even gave them that look on your way to church today. Who knows? Or maybe you go a little more metaphorical when you hear rearview mirror. Maybe you think about the past, glancing back on your life through the rearview mirror, examining the path you've traveled, the high points and low points, things you're proud of, things you're ashamed of, moments you wish you could forget, or moments that you wish you could hold on to forever. I think one of the beautiful things about the Christian life is the perspective that we have on life through the rearview mirror. Now, we don't look in the rearview mirror all the time when we drive, because why? Because we'll crash, because we're looking behind instead of looking ahead. But Jesus gives us the freedom to be able to look back on our lives in a healthy way, at the good, the bad, and the ugly, and learn from our past while knowing our past does not define us. His unconditional love and forgiveness release us from past shame and guilt and allow us to look ahead with hope and resolve. He allows us to look into the rearview mirror through the eyes of healing rather than condemnation. It seems like one of the Apostle Paul's favorite things to talk about in the Bible is the perspective that we have on life through the rearview mirror in Christ. He says in Ephesians, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. It is by grace you have been saved." Later in Ephesians, he says, "For at one time you were darkness, but now you are light. Walk as children of light." Or in Colossians, "Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. Once you were dead, but now you are made alive. Once you were darkness, now you are light. Once you were alienated, now you are reconciled." What a beautiful perspective on life, looking into the rearview mirror through Christ. In the 1600s, there was a French monk who is known today simply as Brother Lawrence. Brother Lawrence lived in a monastery as a kitchen aide, and he was constantly doing the bidding of his superiors there, an existence that many of us would probably consider monotonous and maybe even miserable. The reason that Brother Lawrence is not forgotten by history is his profound but simple approach to practicing the presence of God in every moment of life, even in the most mundane tasks. And he knew plenty about mundane. In what has become a classic work, The Practice of the Presence of God, Brother Lawrence has this to say about reflecting on his past. He says, "I consider myself as the most wretched of men, full of sores and corruption, and who has committed all sorts of crimes against his king. The king, full of mercy and goodness, very far from chastising me, embraces me with love, makes me eat at his table, serves me with his own hands, gives me the key of his treasures. He converses and delights himself with me incessantly in 1,000 and 1,000 ways and treats me in all respects as his favorite. It is thus I consider myself from time to time in his holy presence." We know the wretchedness and the corruption that's in our pasts. But like Brother Lawrence, when we look into the rearview mirror in light of Christ's presence in our lives, we see God's embrace. We see his invitation to his table and his delight in us. Looking back also gives us a better vantage point to see how God has been with us and how he has worked in our lives. Often we're so caught up in the moment and the way can be so uncertain and confusing in the present that we have a hard time seeing more than an arm's length in front of our noses. And so we just kind of keep our eyes on the 3 feet of pavement that we can see in front of us. It can be hard to see where God is and how he's working in those times. But when we look back, we have the perspective of time and of being beyond those 3 feet of pavement that we couldn't see past in that moment. And we can see times in the rearview mirror when God was working, when he was opening and closing doors, when we had no idea in the moment. I was a 21-year-old college student about to graduate, and I was feeling like God was calling me to go to seminary, but I didn't know where. There are lots of good seminaries out there. Very few of those are cheap. There was a school in Illinois I knew of, very good reputation. I had some friends who've gone there. Maybe I'll go there. But I don't know. Illinois, I'm not sure I like the cornfield to people ratio there. Then one of my professors tells me about the seminary at Lipscomb University. He says, go take a look. Talk to the people there. A few months later, I'm moving to Nashville, enrolled full-time in Lipscomb Seminary. I get a part-time job at a retail store near my apartment in Bellevue to help pay the bills. Not loving it, but it's helping me get by. A few months later, I'm feeling kind of restless. I'm loving my retail job even less at this point and really want to be working full-time in the church. I feel like that's where God is calling me to work. But where? One day, my friend Jeremy, who moved to Nashville around the same time I did, tells me I should come talk to the leadership at his church in Franklin, where he works, about coming on as an intern to fill an open position for a few months, if nothing more. 4.5 years later, here I still am. I wasn't so sure of things when it came time for the what's next after college decision. I wasn't so sure of what God was up to when I was working the retail job in a new city, feeling as though God was calling me to work full-time in his church. But in the rearview mirror, there's God, plain as day, opening and closing doors in his timing, leading me through to today. What a magnificent thing to look back in life through the rearview mirror in Christ. Now, I don't want to patronize you in your present difficulties. I know that most of you are facing challenges far greater than where to go to seminary, when the marriage is struggling, the bank account is running dry, and the sickness is getting worse. Sometimes hearing just wait till you get on the other side of this really isn't all that helpful of a thing to hear, because you're not on the other side of it. You're right in the middle of it. And some stories might not have a nice, neat, happy ending where everyone gets the dream job and the dream spouse and the perfect bill of health. But I do know that God is in the redemption business. I don't understand how he does it, but he takes the messes that we find ourselves in, whether they're our fault or someone else's fault or no one's fault, and he somehow brings beauty out of the ugliness and life out of death. Jesus tells us he's come so that we might have life and have it to the full. He transforms his disciples along the way of following him, through the ups and downs, the good and bad. And he makes new creations out of us when we walk in his ways. And few people can attest to that more than Peter. We've been immersing ourselves in some accounts in Scripture involving Peter these last few weeks. We've seen Peter, a great Christian leader, was at his best when he was pointed toward Jesus and when he was pointing people in the same direction. We've also seen how he was at his worst when he took his eyes off Jesus. And I think if Peter were to look in his rearview mirror at the end of his life, he would tell us the same. So today I want us to join Peter at the end of his life. Church historians tell us that Peter died a martyr, crucified upside down in Rome under the emperor Nero for his faith in Jesus as Lord. So I want us to join Peter on his last night on earth, in a cold jail cell in some dark corner of Rome, awaiting his execution the next day. And perhaps if we listen closely enough as we crowd into this jail cell with Peter, we might hear something of our own stories in Peter's story, and we might even gain some wisdom for our lives today. Peter is an open book here at the end of his life. What do you have to lose when you know you're at the end? And he tells us he'll answer any question we have. So someone decides to just jump into the deep end right off the bat and says, "Peter, what's your biggest regret in life?" Peter sort of chuckles briefly, and he begins to recall a story from a chilly night in Jerusalem around a charcoal fire. John records it for us in chapter 18 of his gospel. Jesus has just been arrested, taken away by a detachment of Roman soldiers and Jewish religious leaders, betrayed by one of his own disciples. Peter cringes as he recalls drawing his sword and swinging it at one of the servants' heads who was there, desperately trying anything he could to keep Jesus from being taken away. Nothing good would come from him being taken away by Roman soldiers for questioning. But at Jesus' instruction, he sheathes his sword and watches as Jesus is taken away. Peter and one other disciple then follow after Jesus as he's being taken away. Kind of a risky move for a guy who just tried to pick a fight with them. Where are they taking him? He remembers thinking. What are they going to do with him? Eventually, they come to the courtyard of the high priest. They approach the gate after Jesus has gone inside, trying to catch a glimpse of what's going on in there. The other disciple who's with Jesus gets into the courtyard because he apparently has some connections within the circle of the high priest. But Peter has no such connections in high places. So he's left waiting alone outside in the cold. I wonder what's going on in there. If Jesus is in trouble, does that mean I am too? After a few minutes of excruciating waiting in the cold, the other disciple comes back out to vouch for Peter to the gatekeeper. "He's with me. It's cool if he comes in." "Oh," says the gatekeeper, "you aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" What do I say? Will they arrest me too if they know who I am? "I am not," he blurts out as he walks in and then makes a beeline over to a fire with some servants and officials of the high priest to warm himself. Meanwhile, Jesus is inside being questioned by a man named Annas, the former Jewish high priest and father-in-law of the current high priest, Caiaphas. He's asking him questions about his teaching and his disciples. An official strikes Jesus in the face for not answering a question the way he thought he should. And then Jesus is sent off to further questioning to Caiaphas. Outside in the courtyard, Peter is still warming himself by the fire with the servants and officials of Caiaphas. His senses are keen. He knows that at any moment he too could be arrested. The wall's kind of crumbled over there, he thinks. I bet I could climb over it and get out if I needed to. But better just keep quiet and maybe they won't notice me at all. But he was obviously not one of them, this rural fisherman. He didn't have the look of someone who belonged in the lofty courts of the high priest. He stuck out like a sore thumb. So the servants and officials, noticing him, ask the same question the gatekeeper did. "Hey, you aren't one of his disciples too, are you?" "Just keep calm," he thinks, which is easier said than done for Peter. But he keeps his composure and sticks to his story. "I am not," he says again. But this time he didn't get off the hook so easily. One of the high priest's servants standing there by the fire, a relative of the man who lost an ear to Peter's sword in the garden earlier that night, recognizes him from the garden. "Didn't I see you with him in the garden? Yeah, that's you. You tried to start something in the garden. You cut off my cousin's ear. Well, sensing all eyes on him and his circumstances worsening, Peter denies being in the garden and being a disciple of Jesus for a third time. We can see the sadness in his eyes as he tells us this. And he says, as soon as those words of denial left my mouth, a rooster crowed. Now, why would this be such a painful memory for Peter? Because a few short hours earlier, some of Jesus' last words directly to Peter before his arrest were, before the rooster crows, you will disown me three times. Now, in that moment, Peter must have thought, there's no way. I love you, Jesus, and you're saying I'm going to disown you three times before the night is over? But sure enough, a few hours later, Peter remembers, there I stood by the fire, having denied Jesus, the man I believed to be the Son of God, three times in one night. I was so selfish and afraid, he said, and I remember it so clearly. When Jesus was questioned about his identity by the soldiers in the garden, he said, I am he, and he defended all of us. But when I was asked about my identity as a disciple of Jesus, I said, I am not, thinking only of myself. When I heard that rooster crow, I felt lost. I didn't know who I was in that moment or where I was going. I felt like an outsider. I didn't know where my place of belonging was. I felt shame. I had acted as a coward in the face of conflict. And that, Peter says, is my biggest regret. Looking in the rearview mirror through Christ doesn't erase the mistakes or the bad things that happened along the way. Those things still happened and they still affect us. But they don't define us. They don't own us. They don't hold us back from a hopeful future. So after a period of silence, after Peter recounts this story to us, someone else decides to ask, what's the most vivid memory you have of all your time with Jesus? Again, Peter sort of chuckles briefly. So many stories he could tell. But he settles on one and begins a story of breakfast by the sea. Wouldn't you know it? Around a charcoal fire. John once again records it for us in his gospel in chapter 21. Over a week had passed at this point in time since Jesus' resurrection. Jesus had been beaten, crucified, and buried. He was in the tomb, dead for 3 days, but had then been raised to life. Mary Magdalene had seen him. The remaining disciples had seen him. Thomas had put his hands into the wounds on Jesus' hands and in his side and believed in his resurrection. And things, understandably, felt different. All of Jesus' confusing sayings about having to be put to death and then raised to life were now making sense. The disciples had the advantage of seeing all this through the rearview mirror now. And as they were processing all of this, Peter decides the best way for him to process was to do something he was familiar with. So he grabs his fishing nets and he hits the water and takes a few of his friends with him. They've had a long night of fishing with nothing to show for it out on the water. Usually the kind of night that was forgettable on a fishing trip, but this trip wasn't over quite yet. It's early in the morning and they're thinking of making their way back into the shore and calling it quits. But then they hear a voice from the shore. Hey, friends, have you caught any fish? No, we've been out here for hours, haven't caught a thing. Try this. Throw your net onto the right side of the boat, and you'll find some. Ah, great, we've got an expert on our hands. Oh, well, what do we have to lose? So the disciples toss their net onto the right side of the boat, and wham, more fish than they can haul in. John then realizes who it was calling to them from the shore. It wasn't just some crazy, random local guy who knew which side of the boat all the fish were on. It was their friend, the risen Lord, Jesus. In classic Peter fashion, he jumps into the water in the early hours of the morning to swim to Jesus, because waiting in the boat to get to shore would be far too safe and conventional for him. And he and the disciples join Jesus on the shore for a breakfast of fish and bread around a charcoal fire as the sun was coming up around the sea. Your relationship with someone changes after you've walked through a fire with them. Not to mention when they've died and been brought back to life. Somehow the normal small talk just seems inconsequential. As they're sitting around the fire, munching on bread and fish, the disciples are just dying to ask Jesus about those 3 days he was in the tomb. Were you battling Satan during those 3 days, Jesus? Did you win? What was it like taking that first breath again? Do you remember anything at all? But no one could quite get up the courage to ask him these questions. So they enjoy one another's company and the fresh fish and the morning air and the breeze coming off the water. As they're finishing up, Jesus sort of stops his general conversation with the group and starts talking directly to Peter, who's still a little damp from his swim. Simon, Peter's other name was Simon. Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Peter recalls for us in the jail cell, his heart rate quickening a bit in this moment when he heard Jesus say his name. He was still dealing with some lingering shame from his denials, a sense of feeling like an outsider because of his cowardly actions, wondering if Jesus still wanted him as a disciple. But Peter still loved Jesus, deeply loved him. So when Jesus asked Peter if he loved him more than he loved the disciples who were sitting around the fire, Peter answered, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Feed my lambs," Jesus responds. "Okay," Peter thinks, I think that's a good sign. Could this mean Jesus isn't done with me yet? Before he has time to chase that thought any further, Jesus asks him again, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." "Take care of my sheep," Jesus says. I wonder why Jesus would ask me this again, Peter thinks. Then a third time, Jesus says to Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Well, at this point, it hits Peter square in his core. Three times he denied Jesus in the courtyard of the high priest, and three times Jesus has now asked him, "Do you love me?" So with the blood rushing to his face and his heart pounding in his chest, wondering if this would be the moment when Jesus cast him aside for his unfaithfulness, Peter frantically responds, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." "Feed my sheep," Jesus responds. Whew. Jesus had every reason to disown Peter. An eye for an eye, the law says. Peter had disowned Jesus so Jesus could disown Peter. Peter had wilted at the first sniff of conflict, so how could Jesus trust him to lead his church moving forward? But instead of hearing, "Get out of my sight," or "I'm done with you," from Jesus, Peter hears, "Feed my lambs. Take care of my sheep. Feed my sheep." Jesus was not done with Peter yet, not by any means. And Peter's love for Jesus could only be complete by tending Jesus' flock. The disciples sitting there around the fire, and those who would believe in Jesus as Lord in the coming days and months and years. So as Jesus feeds Peter around the fire, he sends Peter to feed his flock moving forward. So Jesus reinstates Peter, moving him from the shame of his denials to the honor of his confessions of love, from being on the outside of his fellowship to the center, from a place of lost wandering to a place of purposeful discipleship. "Feed my sheep." Jesus wasn't quite done with Peter here on the shore. He continues, "Very truly I tell you, When you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." And as Peter sits in his jail cell the night before his execution, he tells us, "And follow him I have. I followed him to the point of beating and imprisonment. I followed him to the point of breaking long-standing, stagnant religious barriers by fellowshipping and eating with Gentiles who had been considered outsiders. I followed him to the point that I'm going to lose my life for my devotion to him. Has it been worth it?" one of us asks him. "Oh yes," Peter says, "it's worth it. I've seen the risen Lord. I've seen the empty tomb. I've walked with him on the shores of Galilee. I denied knowing him on the night of his death, and he still showed me grace and called me to follow him. I was so full of shame, but he restored me. I was a frightened outsider, but he took me back in. I was an aimless wanderer, but he gave me direction. I'm going to die tomorrow," Peter says, "but every step that's led me to this point has been worth it." And then Peter pauses, and he scans the room, and he looks at all of us, and he says, "And what about you?" Jesus has put the same call on your life that he's put on mine. Follow me. And the same life is available to all of us. So as you scan your life through the rearview mirror, can you see the same life-giving impact of the resurrection of Jesus? Do you see that movement from shame to honor, or from isolation to belonging, from wandering to discipleship, from death to life? If not, how will you respond to the call of Jesus? But beware, Peter says, because the call of Jesus is a dangerous one, as many who have accepted the call will tell you. See where it's led me. If you accept this call, the road will not be easy. And Jesus isn't kidding when he says, if you want to be my disciple, you must take up your cross and follow me. Following Jesus has quite literally led me to a cross, Peter says. But it's through dying to myself that I have lived the most meaningful, adventurous, satisfying, love-filled life that I could have ever imagined. You very well may be in the midst of difficulty today. You may only be able to see about 3 feet of pavement in front of you. You may not be able to sense exactly how God is working in your present circumstances. But I think Peter would tell us that if we follow Jesus through whatever it is that we're experiencing, Jesus will enact his redemptive purposes in our lives. Sometimes in big ways, sometimes in subtle ways. Sometimes in ways we can see in the moment, sometimes in ways we can't. I think if Peter were speaking to us, reflecting on his life at the end, a man who had walked with Jesus, he might just say something like this: "Though you have not seen him, you love him. Though you do not now see him, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls." I think if Peter were here talking to us this morning, he would tell us that following Jesus is worth it.